Hello and welcome to The Trust Show. I'm Tom Aylott and today we are joined by one of the biggest names in UK asset management, Nick Train. Nick rose to prominence managing the Lintel Train UK and Global Equity Funds, as well as the Finsbury Growth and Income Investment Trust, where he generated some of the highest returns on the market throughout the 2010s, thanks to his distinct quality growth style. Finsbury, which is now run for 25 years, was up a whopping 366% over the previous decade, tripling the 188% gain made by the FTSE All Share Index, cementing Nick as one of the UK's star fund managers. Performance in recent years, however, has taken a very different turn, with Finsbury falling almost 10% over the past 5 years. Welcome to the show, Nick.
Tom, thank you. I'm not sure I thank you for reminding me about the last few years, but here we are.
Yeah. Well, I hope you don't mind if we do sort of start off by talking about performance, seeing as it is probably the main thing on investors' minds at the moment. Would you mind sort of giving, in your own words, a bit of background to what has been going on the past 5 years and what has led to that sort of very different performance over that period?
Well, sure. I mean, just for my own purposes, just a bit of context. So the first 20 of those 25 years were pretty satisfactory, I think. And, you know, I think you articulate it well. We've sought to be the best quality growth managers that we can possibly be. And I think we did have some real winners and successes. But there's no question, in the benefit of hindsight, we were advantaged by, in particular, that 10-year period of 2010 through to, say, 2021, 2022, when quality growth really, really worked. And the sad fact is, for a variety of reasons, over the last 5 years, not only has value trounced quality growth, and with us trying to be the best quality growth managers we can be, we've not been in value. And that's been a big headwind. And I'm sure we'll come on to talk about individual stocks. I have to also acknowledge that there have been two or three really disappointing stock hits that shareholders have suffered, and that too has, you know, impinged on our returns. Looking forwards, I've got to be so careful about predicting a bright, imminent future, because who knows? But what I do feel is so important to communicate to long-suffering shareholders right now is that the investment approach hasn't changed, for good or for ill, but at least we've not flip-flopped. We're still doing what we've always said that we will do. In my and my colleagues' opinion, we own some extraordinarily high-quality UK companies with a big growth opportunity ahead of them, and that ought to work. Okay, with one or two exceptions, and we will come to these, with one or two exceptions where there have been business performance issues, there have, but by and large, over the last 3 or 4 years, the core holdings in this portfolio have done pretty well as businesses, even if their share prices haven't. And that kind of gives some confidence as well. So I don't know. Is that a fair enough summary of the question?
Yeah. Like you say, there has been a lot of external factors impacting sort of quality growth and things. How much of that do you think is also a UK problem as well? Sentiment against sort of UK companies. Do you think, you know, that strategy might have performed better if it was more global?
Well, you can't know the answer to that. What I feel is that for sure the long period of very disappointing returns from UK equity assets has resulted in mispricings right across the UK market, and we've sought to take as full an advantage of those mispricings as we possibly can. I have to admit, it's a source of real frustration to me and my colleagues that I sort of feel we've been dedicated cheerleaders for the UK stock market for the last 10 years, and still are, by the way. But it's so painful that in the last 18 months, when the UK has generated better returns, we failed to participate. And listen, I'm not being denigrating any type of investment strategy. I'm not denigrating at all any other type of investment approach. But it is frustrating that it's been a classic value rally in the London stock market over the last 18 months that's generated the improved returns. And our, in our opinion, world-class steady growth businesses that have carried on growing just haven't participated. But it doesn't have to stay that way forever. That's what we've got to believe.
Yeah, yeah. What do you see is sort of what is your outlook? Are those sort of headwinds likely to persist in the near term? Do you see an improvement anytime soon?
What I think, and I, you know, I just have to put it in these terms. And again, I put it in the context of the 25 years that we've been running the strategy. That's quite a long time. There have been multiple market and economic cycles over the last 25 years. Things have come in and out of fashion over the last 25 years. But a strategy of running a concentrated portfolio, and Finsbury is very concentrated, that's exacerbated both the good years and the bad years. Running a concentrated portfolio, concentrated on what, as objectively as you can, analyze to be outstanding businesses, that's generated competitive returns over time. And all I know is, if the companies we're invested in can grow over the next few years at the rate that the companies are predicting, and we kind of concur, then I can see no reason why their share prices shouldn't go up a lot. And I ask disappointed shareholders, and I'm a very disappointed shareholder in Finsbury, I ask shareholders just to look at the top 10, the top 15 holdings in this portfolio, and just note that they are excellent businesses, global businesses, with, in our opinion, really obvious growth opportunities ahead of them. And that ought to work. So let's hope. As to catalysts, you never know. But a catalyst in the past, a catalyst has been takeovers, M&A activity. And maybe it's too soon to be definitive about this, but I note across, let's say, all of Linsall Train's portfolios, actually, that some of our underperforming holdings have begun to receive bids. And that's indicating that they'd underperformed too much and value had become attractive to corporates. So I'm thinking, in Finsbury, we've had a bid this year for Schroders. We've had a kind of bid for Unilever's food assets within the last 10 days. There's a bid possibly on the table for Brown-Forman, the US spirits company, owns Jack Daniels. We're not invested in that in a UK fund, but it's interesting that that spirits industry, which is having a tough time, companies are clearly looking for ways to take advantage of depressed valuations, and Penno and Brown-Forman combining, that's interesting. And just yesterday, a media content company that's been hit because of AI worries, which is Universal Music, that too has received a bid. So I don't know whether those are enough to say this is a turning point for our strategy, but definitely in the past, when you've had takeovers happening, it's a sign that things are beginning to turn. And I hope that's the case.
Yeah, yeah. That's been a very big theme across the market in recent years. A lot, obviously, you mentioned sort of Schroders, and last year Hargreaves, one of your other holdings, was sort of was purchased. How does that sort of shrinking market affect investing in the UK? Do you think that is a sign that that people are recognising the value there, or is it limiting opportunities?
Well, it's both. It's both. We are very conscious that, you know, as I said, we're trying to be as good as we can be at being quality growth investors. And, you know, maybe, and I pick a round number here, maybe there's 30 to 40 companies in the UK that we think you can absolutely, definitively say these are world-class quality growth businesses. Now, 30 to 40, that's enough for us to construct a portfolio, comfortably enough. But if we were to lose 10 to take over, maybe it becomes more difficult. We're not there yet, but I agree with the tenor of your question that for the London stock market to remain relevant or to become more relevant, it needs its world-class growth businesses to both remain independent, but I think even more crucially, to generate strong investment returns for shareholders. I know you're going to ask me about what's worked and what hasn't worked for us, particularly over the last 5 years. Just in this context, actually, our best performer, I wish we'd had more of them, our best performance has been RELX, which is a world-class data and data analytics business. It's at least as high quality as any of its US peers. But the valuation is not and has never been as high as US peers. And we know that the company and some shareholders in the company have suggested that perhaps they should relist that business in the United States, which is where the majority of its revenues are derived. And maybe that would bring a re-rating. Now, listen, I say that, I sincerely really hope from the perspective of the UK that that doesn't happen, because I think it would be such a loss to the London stock market. But one can't deny that that has been a direction of travel over the last, you know, 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, yeah. RELX, and are there other holdings within the portfolio where you'd be unsurprised if they did sort of consider listing, or if they did receive sort of an acquisition offer?
Listen, I really don't want that to eventuate. Let's just repeat myself. Yesterday, Universal Music, UMG, okay, it's a, where's that listed?
Amsterdam.
I mean, has received an approach from a US investor saying you should relist on Wall Street because your shares have been languishing, your valuation is clearly low relative to peers. If you won't relist, we're kind of going to make it happen. I am a career long, 40 plus years, a UK guy. and I intend to remain a UK guy. I'm a believer in this stock market and this polity. I don't want any of this to happen, but yeah, ratings have got to improve. Companies have got to demonstrate that a London listing doesn't just condemn you to a subpar valuation. So we'll see.
Yeah. What will it take for that re-rating? Because at the moment, the direction of travel seems to be going in, you know, it's a shrinking market. Is it like a recognition by investors that these are cheap?
And I hope so. I hope so. The companies that we're invested in are pretty bullish. They're pretty optimistic about their futures. And if they can deliver on that optimism with growth, then the shares should be just fine.
Yeah. In terms of sort of LSEG and RELX, obviously the recent market moves have been sort of, they were kind of swept up in the software sell-off. Do you think there was any truth to sort of some of the market fears about AI disruption with those sorts of companies?
There is a degree of truth, and there is also a degree of uncertainty when you confront the advent of a technology as big and potentially disruptive as this. What I believe is being missed, though, is that the advent of artificial intelligence-enhanced tools ought to be a major, major tailwind or opportunity for these companies. I kind of get the sense with where the share prices are at the moment that investors think that the best outcome would just be the status quo. You know, there's a risk to them, and the upside is it just carries on as before. But again, I just think that that's just plain wrong. When you talk to Erik Engstrom at RELX, or David Schwimmer at LSEG, or Steve Hare, who runs Sage, which is actually a SaaS company, they are, and I think they're warranted to be, they are so enthused at the actual, tangible, happening right now benefits that their businesses are deriving from the application of AI tools to their proprietary 100% owned data assets and market positions. And I mean, this is trite for me to say this. I understand it's trite for me to say this, but you know, LSEG, London Stock Exchange Group, share price peaked about 12 months ago, literally 12 months ago, at £120. The recent low was £70. And at the moment, it kind of would feel wonderful if, I think it's 90 today, if it went back to 120. But actually, we shouldn't be thinking about that. We should be thinking about what could make London Stock Exchange Group shares go to 250. And actually, there are lots of things that could make it go to 250, because that company is absolutely locked into the big value-creating drivers of this next wave of technology innovation. So obviously, it takes two views to make a market. Obviously, I want to believe in the upside because we're invested in these businesses. But it's a classic instance, it seems to me, where a falling share price has made people pessimistic and unwilling to conceptualize about the upside. And
Now that sort of fear has been put into sort of investors' minds, do you think it will take a while to dispel that? It will be a while before they do see that as a growth opportunity.
Listen, I've got to say, you know, we would like some investment performance today, tomorrow and the day after. I mean, I want to believe that, it's interesting. Listen, things happen at unexpected times. 2 days ago, I wouldn't have expected a bid for UMG. Going back to a non-UK company that we don't own. But interestingly, that is another company that's been hit by fears about AI disintermediation. When share prices of intrinsically very strong businesses fall too far, unexpected things happen. I think that the most likely course of events is that there will be a continuation of what's been evident over the last 18 months, which is that the revenue growth reported quarterly by London Stock Exchange Group, by RELX, by Experian, by Sage, by Rightmove, I'm just listing other companies that we own kind of in this theme, it's likely that the revenue growth rates will continue, as they have been doing, to gradually accelerate. The growth rates of the companies are picking up right now, and they're picking up because of the success the companies are having in selling AI-enhanced tools to their captive customers. That's what's happening right now. And confirmation that that continues, I think, could lead to radical changes of perspective. What was that day in early February when Anthropic launched its legal plugin? Actually, totally irrelevant for RELX's legal business. But that day, RELX's share price fell by 15%. Big drop. Single trading session on a piece of news that actually isn't really relevant. Could you see gap ups in these share prices? Yeah, absolutely. I think that you could. When you see London Stock Exchange Group announcing partnerships with Anthropic or with OpenAI, any news or confirmation that these big LLMs recognize that they need to partner with these big data owners, I think that could lead to rapid changes in perception and improved changes of perception for the companies.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about that. These companies, they do have sort of a monopoly over that data currently, but like with those partnerships that you mentioned, is there a risk that they could water down their sort of market dominance by doing that with AI?
I don't think so. And you might imagine it's been one of the first things we've wanted to get comfort from the companies themselves. But the access that the companies give to the LLMs is absolutely limited and constrained. They are not just saying to ChatGPT, here's our database, do with it what you want. They are offering clearly prescribed access to parts of the database. And yeah, I think that makes a whole lot of sense. And it's reassuring. I think, let's put this as a principle here, and let's hope it's the correct principle. But we agree with the proposition that in an era of AI, almost the most valuable thing on the planet is constantly replenishing business data. Anything that is generating enormous amounts of data that has relevance and value for businesses, that's extraordinarily valuable because that sort of data is what the AI tools can learn from and generate insights from. And when you look at the companies that we're invested in, they are all generating, in a totally proprietary way, ever-increasing amounts of data, which is making their historic data more valuable and their current position even more valuable.
You paint a very compelling case for your holdings and how they'll be a beneficiary, but what do you think of the wider sort of software data sector? Do you think there is risk of wider disruption there? Is that what the market's kind of worried about, distinguishing between the sort of winners and losers there?
You know, I have to say, at this point, there is, certainly for the universe of companies that we look at, both in the UK and globally, there is at this point zero evidence of disruption of these companies' business models. What there is a conceptual fear that Anthropic is so big and so powerful, I can't tell you how it's going to take RELX's business away from it, but I think that it might. Now, okay, maybe, but you've got to respond to the way that the world is today. And I mean, I think it's so important to recognize that the companies that we're invested in have successfully negotiated previous technology shifts and indeed have become stronger and more valuable businesses as a result of technology shifts. And it's clear that this technology, this AI technology, is just even more valuable and value creating for them. Again, we're not invested. Well, we are invested actually in SAP, you know, the German-based software company. The chief executive of SAP over the Easter weekend was quoted as saying, "We are on the verge of the most powerful software services ever created." And that is a massive opportunity for incumbents. It seems like a big opportunity to us.
Yeah, yeah. Not software, but your top holding obviously is a Unilever sort of consumer company. That's kind of had its own, been rattled in its own way when it merged its food business with McCormick.
Well, it hasn't happened yet, but it announced its intention to.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, what are your thoughts on that? Would you support that if they do go ahead with it?
I mean, strictly speaking, I don't think that we're being presented with an opportunity to support or not support, because the size of the transaction, although it is a pretty substantive and significant strategic change for Unilever, doesn't need to be put to a specific shareholder vote, which is kind of interesting. But I'm going to say we're about a week into this having been announced, and I'm going to say we have not definitively arrived at a conclusion about it. But I will say, if I may, that we are persuaded that conglomerates don't perform as well as single focus businesses. And Unilever, which has been, I mean, it's been a perfectly satisfactory investment over longer periods of time, but there have been, I've heard the company admit it themselves, it's been not the most successful decade for Unilever. That addressing undervaluation or underperforming assets by splitting the business and having pure play new Unilever will be the HPC assets, and obviously the food assets will go into a pure play food entity with McCormack. That looks like a way that at least offers the possibility of enhanced returns for both sides of Unilever. I mean, McCormack, you know, it's been a pretty successful business, actually. I mean, okay, it's not Nvidia, it's not a tech stock, but, you know, if you look back over 20 years, it's not done badly, actually, McCormack. And here is an opportunity for that previously successful company to combine its business with Unilever's business, create real scale, create big opportunities for efficiencies, and bring an absolutely dedicated focus to maximizing the value out of a food business. I at least feel that it's a credible proposal that's been put to Unilever shareholders. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, it's that sort of the latest in a few sort of spin-offs and asset sales. Do you think that direction operationally is good for Unilever? It kind of improves the investment case for them.
Forgive me if I wasn't clear enough in my previous comments. But yes, I think that businesses go through long, long cycles, particularly when you're talking about a company as venerable as Unilever, where these consumer companies generate cash. That's one of the nice things about them. And the question is, what do the companies do with the cash? Unilever, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, went through a phase of being highly acquisitive and created some value by doing so, but arguably got to the point where the diversification across different categories and essentially industries meant that it had become a conglomerate. It was getting difficult to manage, getting difficult to get full shareholder value for the assets. So yeah, dismantling a conglomerate certainly has the potential to release value. And, you know, people say, and I think they're right, that this current proposal, if it works, it will work because new Unilever, i.e. Unilever without food, new Unilever will be more valuable. And I think that is a credible proposal, because new Unilever will be growing more quickly than the current entity and have higher profitability and arguably a better secular growth opportunity.
Unilever, that's sort of 10% of the portfolio, and I know you've touched on it a couple of times about the fund being concentrated. There's sort of about 20 holdings, top 10 make about 85%. What do you think of that? I've seen that being touted as sort of a benefit in the past, but has that been a bit of a hindrance in more recent years being so concentrated?
Definitely. Portfolio concentration, you know, it is a two-edged sword. There's no denying it. We continue to be hugely influenced by Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, and a lot of the success of Berkshire Hathaway over 50 or 60 years was based on running a highly concentrated portfolio of outstanding businesses and being very, very patient, even through periods of share price underperformance, even through periods of business underperformance, but hanging on to exceptional assets in a concentrated way. And listen, Tom, all I know is that for the first 20 years, that was why Finsbury did well. We had concentrated portfolio in exceptional businesses. Now, we can debate whether the businesses we have today are truly exceptional. I think they are. But I think it would be a massive disservice to Finsbury shareholders to change that investment approach. I mean, at the very, very least, it's very, very different. There really aren't any strategies doing or attempting to do what we're doing here. And, you know, there's this Buffett idea of diversification, holding too many positions in low conviction investments. It's just a route to mediocrity. It's just a route to index plus or minus a bit. I'm fully cognizant of what's happened over the last 5 years, but the approach and the portfolio structure offers the potential for really differentiated performance. And if we're anything like right about the prospects for a RELX, even for a Diageo from here, then performance can be radically different from the benchmark and, let's hope, radically better.
Yeah, yeah. How concentrated will you go? You're still sort of a bit off from the 30% cap. You know, if Schroders exits the portfolio, will you maybe be looking to sort of recycle some of that money?
For sure. There are a couple of more recent holdings which we've initiated where we'd like to find an opportunity to add to those. It's possible that the Schroders capital gives us that opportunity. And we are always looking for new ideas. And again, I think what sort of new ideas? We are fascinated by, and we do find, London-listed companies with world-class business positions and franchises that, in addition, have a data asset attached to that market-leading position, where the data asset can, we think, help accelerate growth rates in the future as they deploy AI on those data assets. I do imagine that there will be a number of new holdings for Finsbury over the next 12 months. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, when you buy companies, you ideally want to hold them forever. That's part of your strategy. But what's it take for you to sell a position? How do you sort of how do you approach your sort of sell discipline?
Selling is difficult. Everybody agrees that knowing when to sell is difficult. I want to repeat something said by one of the Baillie Gifford managers I remember reading maybe 10 years ago now. Okay, selling is difficult, but sometimes holding is difficult as well. When things aren't working, when other things are working, the pressure to sell is very, very strong. And sometimes it's right to sell, of course. But so many investors, both professional and private investors, have a propensity to sell at the bottom. It's just human nature. It's so easy to get bounced out of stuff. So I shiver slightly when you say, oh, you know, you want to hold things forever, because I know how trite, how simplistic it sounds. And I just wanted to make a defense of kind of the proposition of don't sell too eagerly, and definitely don't sell out of things that haven't done very well recently too eagerly, because that is the royal path to poor investment returns. And I do think, you know, there's so much focus on what's going to happen over the next 6 months. So much focus, and I get it. But again, I'd say to anybody, just before you sell, or even before you make an investment decision, just look at a 20-year chart for a business. And it can be very, very reassuring when you look at Relex went to £40 18 months ago. 20 years ago, it was at £4. Okay, the share price has gone from £40 to £26 today. That's been very painful. But at 26, that's still a lot higher than four 20 years ago. Just remember that things will be volatile. Nothing goes up in a straight line. But if you do own a value-creating business, then you're giving yourself a chance, particularly if you don't get bounced out at the bottom, for earning the sort of returns that everybody wants over time. So that's a very long-winded preamble to say, what probably everybody else says, but I can't think of a better answer to it. Sell when the reason that you initially invested is no longer valid, for whatever reason. So I don't know. It's ancient history. We sold out after 17 years. We sold out of an investment in Pearson, and we sold out of that investment in Pearson because the original rationale for the investment actually turned out not to have been valid, and that was the point at which we decided to sell.
Yeah. Although you don't want to sort of sell holdings too eagerly, have there ever been instances where you've thought in hindsight we should have sold earlier or reduced a position earlier?
Let me wear my heart on my sleeve for a minute or two. You know, Diageo peaked at £40 and today it's trading at £14.50. And that's that's awful. And I, you know, I get that most investors, and maybe it's most investors would much rather have sold at 30 and been given themselves the opportunity to think about buying it back at 14. But I have to say, from our perspective, and this may or may not be adequate, from our perspective, just going back to that earlier proposition, the reason to be invested in Diageo as we were in 2001, when the shares were at £4 or £5, they remained the same reasons at 40, and they remain the same reasons today. It's the world's preeminent collection of alcoholic beverage brands, and it is locked into a secular growth trend of consumers around the world drinking less alcohol per capita, but drinking higher quality alcohol. And that is a tailwind for the owner of the best collection of alcoholic beverages in the world. So I don't, you know, that's kind of as close as I would come to discussing the question that you asked me.
You've got a very loyal sort of shareholder base who've, you know, backed you at the continuation vote on the 100-year anniversary. When you speak to shareholders, you know, what do they say they like most about the trust, and what sort of a worry that they often bring up that you reassure them on?
Well, look, I think we've already discussed most of the issues justifiably that get raised. And I guess it does focus around the portfolio concentration. It is wonderful on the upside. It's painful on the downside. Can it be justified? I think myself, in a world of ETFs and index products and index huggers, it is necessary to offer investors a strategy that is radically differentiated. And I think in the final analysis, those shareholders who've stayed with us or added to their holdings have done so because they want us to stick with this investment approach. I it's up to your listeners or viewers to decide. I have to say, right now, my major concern is, I'm unhappy with the performance, of course, but my major concern is, am I articulate enough to be able to convey to shareholders what the opportunity is in the portfolio? When things are going up, it's very, very easy for people to believe, oh, there's value, there's real interest in this portfolio. At this ebb, it's harder. And as I say, this is another opportunity. I've had lots of opportunities to talk with shareholders recently. As I say, my hope is that I have been articulate enough for at least people to think, okay, this hasn't worked, but what do they own? Actually, they do own some pretty interesting businesses in big size. And if in 3 months' time sentiment has turned, this share price could be very, very different. The share price of Finsbury could be very, very different. That's where I'm coming from.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Nick. It's been great to have you on. And thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed the show today, make sure you're subscribed to Citywire Investment Trust Insider for all the latest news on Nick and the investment company sector.